shall exalt himself above them all. And the what we just read, which could be a little bit confusing, the desire of women right there, is probably one of the gods, the false gods, so that is particularly related to women. So he regards neither the true God nor these false gods. No God. All right. Verse 38. But in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses and a god which his fathers did not know. He shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. Verse 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also, the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. And the vision actually goes on a little bit into chapter 12. Now, before we go on to see things on slides, this section, which is actually not, we are not going to go into in great detail here in this session, has now moved from talking about a prophecy of near things, which would take place over the few hundred years after Daniel got the vision, to far things which are going to occur still in the future and are related to the Antichrist. Now, a few things to be said about this. First of all, the verses that we read at the beginning, starting in verse 36, those verses, you could see some of the things in those verses still applying to Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, the verses up until verse 36 were definitely leading up to and including Antiochus Epiphanes. They were what is now history, even though it was future when Daniel had the vision. Now we look at it and say it was history that has now been accomplished. And then starting in verse 36, you start seeing things that, well, yeah, that might be applied to Antiochus Epiphanes, but some things are hard to apply to him from the history. And then definitely by verse 40 and following, you say none of this applies to Antiochus Epiphanes, which means that we have a gap, that is. There is some history that was given as a vision to Daniel, which was future to him, and then there would be a gap to future things, even more future things, regarding the Antichrist. Now, before you say that this is unusual to insert this gap here, understand a few Sundays ago we had a Sunday school entitled Mind the Gap. And we pointed out that in every one of Daniel's visions, the four visions of in the book of Daniel that he had, in every one there is this gap. So it's not so much an unusual thing. In fact, by the fourth vision, we ought to expect it. So when Daniel is describing his first vision in Daniel 7 with the four beasts, by the time you get to the fourth beast, there's a gap between the introduction of the fourth beast and details later on. In Daniel 8, there is a gap between what is described regarding Greece and the Medo-Persian Empire and the Antichrist come. In Daniel 9, there's a gap again. We talked about that in detail. And now in Daniel 11, we find it again. Now, yes, it would have been clearer had there been a verse put in between and said, well, now, you know, many, many, many years will pass, and we're now going to see some things that have to do with the, you know, very end times or something like that. God chose not to put that in there, and we are supposed to learn as we go along, and God has his own reasons for this, that there was a shift in what is being described, and these things are going to come at the end. Now, when we looked at the earlier verses of Daniel 11, in light of history, we were amazed at how closely they aligned. Just fascinating how one detail after another came just into place along with history. I have no doubt that in verses 40 to the end, and even 36 to the end, that when history unfolds itself, they will be seen just as clear that, oh yes, these came to place just as they were said. But I think that if we gave everybody a job to build a story around these verses as to how they come true in all of their details, we might all have different details in our stories. So looking forward, the prophecies are always a little bit more nebulous than when we look back and say, oh, well, now that we see history, look at how it lines up. But there are certain details that are given that will not be missed, and they will not go unfulfilled. Specific places like Edom and Moab and Ammon and Egypt are all mentioned, and these will, and of course the glorious land, Israel itself, these will all come to pass just as it's written. But that will take place in the future. So what we have is Antiochus Epiphanes, a historical figure from the time shortly before Christ, being a type or a picture of the Antichrist to come. And that gives partial reason as to why these verses are pushed up next to each other. That is, just as Antiochus Epiphanes persecuted the Jews and sacrificed the abomination of desolation, and just as he desecrated the temple and exalted himself as a god, and so on, he actually identified himself with the god Zeus, which he made everybody worship. just in a manner like he did, so will the Antichrist when he comes, and they're closely linked. And this is not unique in Scripture. In Ezekiel 28, for instance, the prophecy is given against the Prince of Tyre. And this is a historical figure, the Prince of Tyre. But then the prophecy goes on against the King of Tyre. And any casual reader will think it's talking about the same person. But again, it has shifted, and the King of Tyre is now talking about Satan himself. And the Prince of Tyre was kind of a picture or had some characteristics of Satan himself. So there's a prophecy against the Prince of Tyre, and as you keep reading the verses, it shifts to being against the King of Tyre, which turns out to be a much bigger figure. And the same thing is happening here in Daniel 11. All right, so having said that about the gap that occurs, what I'd like to do is go back to the ending of the historical account. That is the part that has already come to pass. And remember, when Daniel had the vision, it was future for him. He was prophesying. And right now, when I call it history, I don't mean he was writing history. He was writing prophecy. But it's history to us now. So I'd like to go back to the last verses of the part that is history now. And those would be the verses leading up to, say, verse 35. And what I would like to do is I would like to remind ourselves of this revolt of the Maccabees and the persecution of Antiochus Epiphanes, and then carry on a little bit of the history and fill in the gaps from that point to the time of Christ. And I think that that would be helpful to us to see how some of the things that existed at the time of Christ came to be. So I think this is going to be the last time you'll see this picture. It's been up for several weeks. Daniel 11 is about the fights between the northern and the southern empires there, and Jerusalem in the middle kind of gets whacked every time they go back and forth. So they get caught in the crossfire, and we talked about Antiochus Epiphanes, his rise to power. He uses some tricks with his tongue and just says, oh, I know I'm not the heir to the throne, but Demetrius, who is, he's in prison for a while. I'm just caretaker. And he consolidated his power and took over. When he took over, he appointed Jason as the new high priest in Jerusalem. Jason, a liberal, as opposed to the conservative Onias, who was the priest. Jason spread all this awful Greek pagan stuff around. We mentioned that before. Jason transforms Jerusalem for the worst. But then Menelaus comes along, and he gets himself appointed high priest in the place of Jason. And Menelaus said, I'm going to be even worse than Jason. Well, he didn't say worse to Antiochus, but he said, you'll like me more because I'm going to do even more than Jason, and I'll give you more money. And Menelaus is appointed high priest. And what's amazing then is Menelaus is not a descendant of Aaron, which was true of the others, even Jason, up until then. And we saw that there's some fighting between Antiochus Epiphanes and Ptolemy the fifth in sixth in Egypt. And we won't go into that detail, but just to say that Ptolemy the sixth finds himself in big trouble. Not only is he getting beaten by Antiochus Epiphanes, but a rival arises in Alexandria, and he ends up getting more power, and he bumps out Ptolemy the sixth as well. Ptolemy the sixth flees to Rome and says, look, you got to help me out. We have an alliance. It was arranged previous to by my father, but we have an alliance, and you know, when somebody hurts me, they hurt you. I mean, that's our alliance. And Rome says, yes, you're right. So Rome sends down their guy, Gaius Papilius Lannus, to meet Antiochus, and that's the famous line in the sand drawing. So this guy Gaius from Rome tells Antiochus, basically, get out of Egypt, and we don't want to see you here again. And he has terms of his this agreement in his hand, and Antiochus is given this ultimatum that if you continue on in your intention to harm Egypt, you're in war with Rome. And Rome by that point is really gaining power, and Antiochus knows that's not a good thing to do. So Antiochus, trying to save face, says, let me think about it for a day or two and I'll get back to you. And this is when Gaius draws this line in the sand and a circle around him and says, let me make myself clear. If you don't give me an answer by the time you step out of that circle, it will be assumed that you have chosen to be at war with Rome, and we will respond in proper manner. So what else could Antiochus Epiphanes do? Even a proud man, he has to buckle and say, okay, I agree to your terms. So he's humiliated, he's angry, and he's seething and can't take it out on Rome because they're too strong to take it out on. So he goes and he ends up taking it out on Israel because that's where he goes back. He takes it out on Jerusalem. So he does several things there that we talked about last time. He does things that are just intentional, not even that give him any gain himself, but just to stick it to them. He forces Jehovah's name to be changed to Zeus in the temple. Must sacrifice pigs to Zeus. No Sabbath, feast, circumcision. He sacrifices a pig on the altar in the temple and plunders the temple treasury and leaves troops there to enforce all of these things. This started, you know, underground movements. Sometimes people would get caught and tortured and things like that. And tens of thousands were martyred for their faithfulness under the oppression of Antiochus Epiphanes, really is a picture of the Antichrist to come. The Maccabean Revolt we talked about, we'll talk about that a little bit more, but after Antiochus lays down all of these harsh terms on Jerusalem, he leaves his troops there to go to the outlying towns to make sure that they also are adhering to all of these changes. So the Syrians come to a place called Modin, where Mattathias lives. And Mattathias is a priest there, not high priest, he's a priest. And they're telling people to worship and sacrifice to Zeus and to do these pagan things, forcing the idolatry. And some Mattathias says, well, no, I'm not going to do it. So some Jew nearby either decides he's going to curry favor with the Syrians, or maybe he's just going to try and save his own skin, says, okay, we'll do it. He gets ready to do it. Mattathias grabs a sword from somewhere and kills the guy, turns around and kills the Syrian that told him to do it. And I don't know what happened to the rest of the troops with him, but somehow they hightail it out of there. This old guy is about 80 who's doing this. Then he calls for followers, as depicted in this picture, and they launch a guerrilla-type campaign against Syrian forces. Well, in 165, Mattathias dies, but his third son, Judas, he leads the campaign, and he is a very able strategist. So, excuse me. There we go. Just get the numbers in there. So he's nicknamed Judas Maccabeus, which is hammer. He actually wins a lot of these things. He retakes Jerusalem, retakes the temple, and the temple is rededicated. It's cleansed, it's rededicated after 3 years of desecration. And they light the lights in commemoration of this. We talked about all this last time. That's why I'm going through it so fast. And that's today's celebration of Hanukkah, the Feast of Dedication, the Feast of Lights. And the Lord even attended this in John chapter 10. Okay. So what I'd like to do is now talk about what happens after this, and move to the time of Christ very briefly, and give ourselves a flavor of what happened. Now, this, what we're sharing now, goes beyond the vision that Daniel had. This is simply history that took place between Antiochus Epiphanes and the time of Christ. So Antiochus Epiphanes dies in 164. Well, that's good news. And after that, civil war breaks out in Syria, and the effect that this had is to weaken their oppression of Jerusalem. It weakens their oppression because now they're busy fighting each other. Judas gathers power and momentum in Israel because of this weakened state. But Judas, he ends up not just fighting the Syrians, but he ends up somewhat in a civil war because he now aims his power at the liberals. By 162, Syria gets a new leader, Demetrius I. The liberal Jews request salvation from Judas. Judas ends up getting killed in battle. And in his place, his brother, Jonathan, ends up leading. Now, Jonathan is not like Judas. Judas is the hammer. I mean, Judas is ultra-conservative. He is a tactician in battle. But Jonathan is better with diplomacy. And Jonathan has a much more quiet approach to things. And he leads in a far different way. And eventually, the right person ends up getting into power in Syria, sorry, that being this one, And with the right person in Syria, this person appoints Jonathan to be governor and high priest in Israel. And Jonathan ends up dying just after he negotiates independence from Syria. In other words, his diplomacy paid off just before he died. He gets an agreement with Syria that they can be independent. And then Simon, his brother, so this is now the third of Mattathias' sons that's in charge, he negotiates recognized independence not with Syria but with Rome. So now with both Syria and Rome, they have an agreement. And you know he agrees not to be hostile toward Rome, and they agree not to be hostile toward him, toward them. And so they have an independent country of Israel. Now, during Judas Maccabeus fighting, this is the land that they're basically talking about. It's this small little piece around Jerusalem. That's the whole area that's in question. And it turns out every ruler after that in their independent time would expand this area. So under Jonathan, this land expanded by these purple areas here. And then under Simon, which was the third brother, the land expands a little bit anyway from there. But the point is the land is expanding. Now, after there's Simon and the little expansion from him, Simon negotiates the peace. We talked about that. Simon, again, is both ruler and high priest. And this, in Israel's history, in the scriptures, in the Old Testament, you never had the high priest being the same as the king. This could not be because the king was of the line of Judah and the priests were of the line of Levi. There was this separation, if you will, of church and state, if you want to call it that. But this is violated here, and Simon takes both of these positions. He secures Israel's borders, but he was a liberal ruler. He was very Hellenistic. And isn't this very commonly seen? You have someone who starts something who's conservative. And before you know it, a couple of leaders down from this person, the leader is against the very conservative things that the founder started something with. We see this all the time in organizations today. Well, this happened then. So even though Judas Maccabeus was ultra-conservative and fighting for the Old Testament scriptures and, you know, not bowing to the god Zeus and things like that, two people from him is this liberal ruler, and it's actually one of his brothers. Well, he gets assassinated, and in his place, John Hyrcanus takes over. Now, his claim to fame is a significant expansion of the land of Israel. So now he has added in conquest the upper and southern regions that are very, very important. Now, this southern region is Idumea, which is the land of Edom, and that's the land that Edom is another name for Esau. And he does this through kind of a forced conversion. This doesn't really work well. That's why I put conversion in quotation marks. He, by power and conquest, says you have to be converted to Judaism. And they, being conquered physically, say, okay, well, what else are they going to say? But deep down inside, they're resentful of this. And they never got over this. And in fact, there was a very important leader that would come a little bit later from this land called Herod. Herod was an Idumean. He was an Edomite. He was a descendant of Esau. And this idea that, yes, it was Jewish territory because they took it over, but he'd be Jewish in name, but not really. He was an Idumean. He was, and in fact had some resent against Jerusalem. And the same person also conquered this northern territory of Samaria. And it was the same kind of thing. Samaria, the land was conquered, and the areas of worship were taken away, but that only further divided the two areas and only fueled the hostility between them, to where at the time of Christ, you have this documented hostility between the Samaritans and the Jews. And the woman at the well would say, "Why are you speaking to me, a Samaritan, you being a Jew?" And the animosity was was known. Now, by the way, this succession of rulers during the time that they are independent has a name. It's called the Hasmonean dynasty. So as believers, we ought to be conversant in a term like that. If somebody says, "What happened during the Hasmonean dynasty?" we can now say, well, we at least know what it is. It's this succession of rulers that came starting with the Maccabees, the Judas Maccabeus, and descendants of this guy Mattathias. So they had some ancestor named Hasmon, so this is called the Hasmonean dynasty. It's this descendants of that family. All right, after him was Aristobulus, if I'm pronouncing that right. He was a son to the previous ruler, and he added Galilee to Israel's territory. Now, if Samaria was far out, Galilee was like way out there. They even referred to it as Galilee of the Gentiles. That's how far out it was. But Nazareth was in Galilee. So its remoteness made it kind of marginally respected. This was like the power center down here around Jerusalem. In fact, it may lend itself to the words of Nathanael when he heard about Jesus coming from Nazareth. He says, "Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" It might be that it wasn't so bad that Nazareth was such a rough place, but he might have been referring to just Galilee in general. So that gives you some idea of where things are. Remember, this is only 100 years before Christ would be born, what's happening now. Now, it turns out that this guy was pretty vicious toward the Pharisees. And in previous times, I've talked about the Pharisees kind of their roots being seen. But by this time, there really is a group called the Pharisees. And there really is a group called the Sadducees. And the Pharisees were the conservatives. They were the separatists. And that's what Pharisee means. It means separated. Sadducee, by the way, I learned, just I didn't know before, is from the Hebrew word Zadok, which is righteous. Zadok. Now, you've got to shift it to Greek, and Zay kind of becomes a S sound, and the D stays the same, and then the C at the end of Zadok, the C or the K, however you think of it, at the end kind of becomes the CC in Sadducees. So Sadducees, Zadok, they kind of go together. But anyway, that's where that comes from. But they were the liberals. They were the liberals. And this is what, this leader sided along with the liberal side of things, and he was vicious toward the Pharisees. Alexander, after him, added even more to the land of Israel. He further expanded his borders, and he was very harsh toward the Pharisees. A lot of Pharisees died for their faith. So the Pharisees at the time of Christ may very well have had good roots. In other words, they were people that said, "I'm not going to bow down to false gods. I'm not going to adopt these liberal ways. I'm going to adhere to the scriptures." And many of them were martyrs for that. It's the shame was that by the time we got to the time of Christ, their descendants had shifted what the Pharisees started to be into a legalistic group, a separatist group in the sense that, like the Pharisee in the temple would pray, "I thank you, God, that I am not like this man." So there were many, many Pharisee martyrs at that time. After him was Hyrcanus II, and His younger brother, Aristobulus II, drives him out. He was in Jerusalem ruling, and his younger brother drives him out. So in 64 BC, he returns with a mercenary army and puts Jerusalem under siege. Interestingly enough, this is about when Pompey of Rome comes to Israel. And he finds the scene, and he sees Hyrcanus II is kind of on the outs, and younger brother Aristobulus II is in Jerusalem, but Hyrcanus II is trying to get him out. So Pompey comes along and has a little Starbucks coffee with Hyrcanus II. And they sit down and they say, Pompey of Rome says, look, you want to get Jerusalem back. I can tell that. Your brother has it right now. I'll make a deal with you. If you come under the power of Rome and you become a nation that is governed ultimately by Rome, I'll see to it that you are put in charge in Jerusalem and your brother is out, and we'll set order. Well, what could Hyrcanus II say? I mean, if he says yes, he gets to be in charge. If he says no, Pompey's going to do what he wants anyway. So he says, all right, sounds like a deal. And that's exactly what happened. And Pompey leads a successful effort into Jerusalem. And that is the end of Jewish independence in 63. The Hasmonean dynasty actually continues on, even though they're under Rome now, and Herod ends up working out a deal with Rome to take over. He goes to the Roman Senate, and in 37 BC they say, yeah, you've made your case well enough. We think you have good intentions. You can be the leader. And that's how Herod the Great takes over. So the Hasmonean dynasty ends with the Herodian dynasty taking over. So we'll stop there. And Herod the Great was the Herod that was in power when the Lord Jesus was born. The one who said babies in Bethlehem have to be killed.